succession of P&H elevators, so. I've got 6 after 5. So it's a, just short of an hour. Well, no, it's about 45 minutes because we got started.
Oh, we're doing that today.
Sure.
Okay, well, we'll do 3, 2, 1.
We were just talking about P&H, the small self-contained company, and you were saying what their business was.
They're more or less an in-house business where they buy in the prairies in order to service their plants in southern Ontario that handle their butterball turkey production there. So very small plant, very limited. Managed to make money, managed to stay open here, but how much longer, I'm not sure. So then we're going to be faced with, more or less, we're going to be faced with 5 companies left in Thunder Bay with probably 5 facilities.
With these big ones. The moved into, and it would be interesting to explore something of that history.
P&H is Parrish and Heimbecker.
Yes.
Two gentlemen that got together and formed a company, and the grain trade. We're very prolific in the prairies. Has a lot of small places, but because the bigger companies went with throughput elevators, closed down a lot of the country elevators. Basically, that did in a lot of the Patterson elevators, did in a lot of Parrish and Heimbecker. A lot of the smaller plants were shut down.
Yeah.
Well,
I was interested to see
the companies didn't want to serve the railroad companies didn't want to service all those small places, yeah. And so it became more efficient for the farmer to bring the grain to a bigger elevator that they could ship a lot quicker.
I wouldn't want to say categorically how many there were, how many of them were operating, but coming driving up from Shelby, Montana to Lethbridge, early July 08, I was interested to see suddenly this number of P&H to the lakehead, and then on it goes to feed turkeys in southern Ontario.
Right.
And of course for them, then if the turkey production may well be the main business by now, so that here's a matter of acquiring the feed that is required, having their own suppliers in-house, and they can price things accordingly and so on. And the closure of all of these elevators, of course, suggests that we might consider getting someone from the tax department of the city to give us an interview sometime about commercial and industrial taxation, the tax base of the city, which must be powerfully impacted by the closure of all of the
I've heard, Ernie, in the comparison between Duluth and Thunder Bay, the cost factor for taxes for a plant here are upwards of $1 million a year, and I've heard as low as $50,000 a year for the same plant in Cargill has a plant in Duluth and has a plant here, and I think the difference is $50,000 to $100,000 compared to $1 million here. So a company has to really look at that and say, you know, like,
how to be real value here.
Yeah, we're plugged in Thunder Bay. There are no sails, no boats coming. I think we've had one salty here in the last month, and so when you have those fixed costs and you don't have the turnover, the ability to unload and ship grain, which these companies depend on. You know, it really is detrimental.
Sure. We were examining stages of the business and so on and so forth, various grains. What about your own progress up through the ranks, so to speak, of the Grain Commission? You began as an assistant inspector, and how did your work change over the years as you advanced in the commission?
Well, with everything else in the grain industry, computers, Canadian Grain Commission, used to do everything mechanically, everything was done by hand. We would record all of the different grades on long sheets and add the weights of each boxcar to the sheets and then submit the sheets at the end of the day. Now that has all changed. We do it electronically. We use computers for nearly all of our work. All our input data is done on a computer. So in our central office, which is on Archibald Street in Thunder Bay. So it's a huge change in the ability and how we do our work, and much more efficient. And definitely with that efficiency, less staff is required in order to do that.
Right.
So, you know, it's just
so this would change the character of the
computer
of the
age,
work quite clearly.
Computer age has changed drastically.
Did the kind of work that you were required to do change otherwise as you... At some point, you became no longer an assistant, but a full-fledged grain inspector, I suppose.
Well, you do that You do that through the amount of, writing different exams and promotions. In order to become a grain inspector, I had to serve roughly 5 years as an assistant and become familiar with all the different end products of the, and they changed the ever-changing end products, say, because of the different requests from different buyers for little, like you had right. said, niche markets.
Yeah.
So I had to, for all the different varieties, time to, it's almost like an apprenticeship. So sure. I basically served my apprenticeship, went through that cycle as promotions became available, meaning competitions in order to become an inspector. I successfully completed that process and with it became an inspector. And my job changed, from what I did as an assistant to what I do as an inspector.
Yeah. Which then qualified you to to certify things, to assert things, to sign to things yeah. that you couldn't do earlier?
Yeah, so now as an inspector, what I can do is I certify the grade at unload. So when it's unloaded, I examine it. We do other tests, and I have assistants that help me do other tests on it. I apply a grade to it. That grade is still can be reviewed by the Chief Inspector of Canada at the request of the farmer or the agent. He can have that looked at and reviewed if they're not happy with the particular grade that I have given it. Mm-hmm. I also do vessel loading. I load approval of any grains that are discharged into either tankers for shipment domestically for export to the United States via rail or overseas or domestically via boat. So I'm able to do that. On my job, I've traveled to Quebec City in the wintertime to help them when we bypass grain from Thunder Bay, it goes directly from the prairies to Quebec City.
The Northern
we load
line.
Boats there. As I mentioned before, 70 countries that require grain require it all year round now. And so a country like Algeria does not have the money to pay for it, so they'll require 30 days in advance for a boat to be loaded for arrival in a port to be discharged. So. I've worked in Vancouver with the Canadian Grain Commission when they're busy. We've gone there and helped in the wintertime there. So I've traveled quite a bit extensively across Canada and I'm able to load and supervise the loading of grain across Canada. That's basically my job.
Right. And are there gradations with the experience that you've had?
You'd like to think that seniority would play a factor, but it doesn't. Federal government, its merit has always been the criteria for advancement in civil service, and always
but
will be.
Are there just the two assistants and then grain the chief inspectors, you said, at the top of it all.
But, right.
But as inspectors, you're one group,
right.
Or are there gradations?
We work under the Public Service Alliance of Canada. We are in the technical trade group, TC group they call it. I'm a PI, primary products inspector. We're the last primary products inspectors in Canada left. All the other ones have been moved from primary products inspectors, such as plant and animal inspectors, egg, dairy inspectors, meat inspectors, have all been moved into the engineering group. And we're the actual last group in the primary products inspection bunch. And so that group involves inspectors, it involves assistant inspectors, and we're now moving towards a cross-based system between the weighing staff and the inspector, so that we can be more fully integrated and able to do the process, of the total process.
Yes, right. You mentioned a farmer's complaint. Of course, I grew up on a small 240-acre farm, and I don't suppose our crop would ever have filled a car, but farmers who are working several sections and produce a great deal of grain will certainly be shipping a car of their own product so that they could have the grade double-checked here, I suppose. Oh, yeah. Does that happen very often?
Frequently, because there's lots of producers now that want to that aren't involved with the Canadian Wheat Board.
Or are hostile to it.
They're hostile to it or want to work outside the system, and so they ship directly to a company here, or they deal with a company on the prairies that has a terminal in Thunder Bay. Yeah. So they may deliver to Patterson Elevator. Patterson may have a grandfathered arrangement with James Richardson, which involved the producer, who is the farmer, delivering his grain to an agent for Patterson, getting a price from him, getting a grade from him, and unload here, that changes. So he has the option of asking the chief inspector. Usually it's a subordinate, Thunder Bay, meaning my, what we have now is an inspection specialist in Thunder Bay in our central office who will look at it and decide at that time.
On behalf of the chief inspector?
On behalf of the chief inspector. He will look at it initially, and if he feels that there is a warrant for it to be changed, he can move it to the chief inspector. That sample will be taken and shipped to Winnipeg, and chief inspector will have the final say on that.
Who actually owns the grain at the various stages? Do you have a sense of that as inspector?
Oh, definitely, yeah, definitely. Aside from the producer, then who ships
the
by himself, it's owned by the tract to the farmer to grow a certain variety of grain for them. And so when that grain is delivered by the farmer to either the agent who represents Canadian Wheat Board, the agent takes charge of it on behalf of the company. And so he signs in a note saying, okay, you've delivered 2 red to me, this is what you're going to be paid. The Canadian Wheat Board gives him a bonus to that if at the end of the year they make money on it, he'll get an addition to that.
If he delivers it, let's say, to a Viterra throughput elevator somewhere in Saskatchewan or wherever these days on the prairies, and it arrives here, Viterra is providing the service,
right.
Is it not? It isn't actually owning it. It's the wheat board that does own
the ship. The companies that handle the grain are paid by the Canadian Wheat Board / the farmer for handling the grain. So that means they get paid roughly $1,600 a tanker to unload it, clean the grain. They get paid for that. If they have to dry the grain, they get paid for that. They also get a percentage of dockage out of the grain. When they clean it, they get to keep that.
Yes.
And they also get paid for shipping the grain to a vessel. So for every function that they do, they get paid.
Yes.
Now, if they can streamline their functions, if they can have less staff there, if they can make a product better by adding things to get the volume up, keep the same product, that's where they make their money.
Sure.
And there's, you know, that's what we're there as a Canadian Grain Commission. We're there to police the fact that these companies
that they're not getting quarters of the quality.
Well, yeah, because well, nowadays you don't really have to worry about that, because if a company ships a non-board grain, which they ship a lot of, the canola is a non-board grain, it's not handled by the Canadian Wheat Board, then if they ship that to a customer and the customer says, well, this isn't what I that, you know, it's not what I'm coming on. They're
mindful
not
of these
they're there
potential problems.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I guess that's a good reminder that the Wheat Board is concerned with wheat and barley and oats as well.
The marketing agency.
The barley, of course, has been one of the grains in dispute on the prairies, hasn't it, whether the Wheat Board should have
Don't see much barley anymore, though, eh? It's all, it's basically lost its... any barley that's produced is used out in the right on the prairies for hog plants there, for feed out there.
Yeah.
Any specialty barley is grown under contract to, I'm thinking of Budweiser or one of the big American brewing companies. They'll contract out right to the farmer to get that grain handled.
And that, of course, was one of the arguments for the Western Grain Transportation Act, for the reduction of the subsidy to the railways, that the grain would be...
Canadian Wheat Board is a huge advantage for the Canadian farmer, as far as I'm concerned. It's a marketing tool. They can market to 70 countries that rely on a company. Viterra is a big company, and they could do it, but I mean, it's...
Viterra is presumably aiming to be a competitor with the Cargill and the several other huge companies in the U.S. who are, I guess, dominant in the world grain industry. And so anyway, we won't pursue the politics of that. I'm completely on side with you. The Wheat Board's a great advantage, but we don't want to debate that.
Americans tell us that all the time.
The Americans tell you that.
That's for
sure. Well, I'm pleased to hear that. What would you like people to know about the work that you do and the places you work?
Well, I think that's a good one, because basically we're undergoing, I'm not sure if you gentlemen are familiar with the fact that we're undergoing a review right now in Parliament at second level to disband the Canadian Grain Commission, a lot of the functions that we do. So,
well, I understand that my Member of Parliament put a shaft into the spokes on that,
yeah.
Moved by the
so,
government.
So yeah, they did a hoist amendment on it. So we're in the process right now of it being a lengthy 2-hour discussion on it at second level, so second reading. So basically, I'm thinking that they're in the near future, they're going to move forward with trying to disband the service that we do in relation to the Canadian Grain Commission's inward inspection, inward weighing, and only inspect vessels that are for foreign destinations.
What's the argument that they have for that? Is there
I guess any they sense feel that I guess they feel the politicians, etc., feel that the party in power feels that it's that what we do now is not warranted anymore. That the industry itself can police itself. That the industry actually tells the farmer what they want them to grow for them, provides them with the necessary payment for that based on world prices or market value, and handles it all and gets their own customer and sells it and that. So the free trade or the ability to trade to handle their own business is what I think that deregulation is the word I'm looking for.
Well, of course, deregulation has gone on in so many areas since the 80s. That is quite a history to all of that. And of course, the view that the industry should take care of itself, that's always the question. Who are they actually taking care of?
Are they able to do that? That's the good one, because basically the CEOs in places that we don't talk about feel that they can do it, and the rank and file here in Thunder Bay rely on the Canadian Grain Commission for not only documentation, for our expertise, for our help. They look at us as cheap insurance, a third-party cheap insurance that they're going to have to provide somebody to help them. If we're disbanded, they're going to have to look at a provider such as SGS or Intertech, another company that does sampling services, to come in there to be a third party, because they know that somewhere down the road somebody's going to say to them, well, that isn't what you shipped, and I put certain grain in it, and then I went over to P&H, they put another grain in it, their grain was no good, my grain's good. So we're cheap third party insurance, and I think that we do a realistically good job with our accuracy levels, our ability to distinguish any problems that are happening. So I think that in the end, in hindsight, it's going to be a mistake. But in the meantime, it's making its way through Parliament, and the political will is to do that, to try it. And so,
do you have any sense that Cargill, as the main American interest in the Canadian grain industry, is unhappy about the activities of the Grain Commission? Would they prefer to do it themselves?
I don't think I can't really say that that's the case. I think the case is more or less the same theory about as the Canadian Wheat Board, that it's strictly Canadian, politically driven. That the party in power feels that they feel that they that their deregulation. That they can do it themselves. I don't think I can. I'm sure we hear from the Americans that we have a big advantage because we have the Canadian Wheat Board. We have that in place, or the American farmer doesn't have that. But we're not really so much in competition with the Americans as I think that some American farmers think we are. Mm-hmm. We sell a certain amount to the states. Yes, we sell a lot more to Mexico.
A compliment, if you will, to the American.
Yeah. So I feel that I think it's more or less just something that's just a situation.
Well, it's pure ideology. Yeah. The conviction that government should provide opportunity for private enterprise, if you will, in the marketplace, rather than provide the service through unionized, well-trained, well-paid workers in the government ranks. I think covers an awful lot of activity in the last 30 years, I'm inclined to say, in a lot of various areas.
But the cost, the cost of our services to a bushel of grain is very small percentage.
Yes. Oh,
So whether that's going to be to the benefit or the detriment of the farmer, time will tell.
Yes.
In the meantime, that process is going through. And that process has been going through since we lost Russia. The Canadian Grain Commission employees have been through many, many, many tough times with the attempt at downsizing our rank and file, the losing of a huge customer like that. Then we lost a lot of we became more of a seasonal port, ever more so than we were before, because even when we were shut down here in the wintertime through the ice,
we would still ship grain via tanker, via boxcar, to Quebec City, to Montreal for further export out to Russia. So we've gone through a lot of, I've been laid off, attempted to be laid off, all kinds of stuff over the years, year after year after year. So it basically, this is now the culmination of trying to do totally away with the position, with the job.
What might interest or surprise people most about the work that you do?
I don't think as much anymore as there may have been prior to food scares that we've had out in the Maple Leaf Foods, where they know that now agricultural inspectors, CFIA, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, was overseeing the work of the plant workers for Maple Leaf Foods. In different places, they are more, I think more the Canadian public is aware that there is government inspection of these products. I think that maybe years ago that a lot of people wouldn't have known what an inspector did, Canadian agricultural inspector did. I think that people are more knowledgeable nowadays, and whether they thought we do as much as we do involved in the process, doing as many checks and...
Whether there be enough done.
Yeah.
I think the to oversee is a lovely verb, and the great danger, it seems to me, is that those who are responsible for overseeing may end up overlooking things.
Because
there aren't enough of them.
And that's a good overlooking. That's a good point, Ernie, because we don't oversee. We actually do different tests. Okay, we're not overseeing anybody else doing these tests. We do the tests for the farmer. We do the tests for the buyer. We do the tests for the elevator company that's requiring where to bin this grain and what to do with it. They come to us for our level of expertise. So we do a lot of hands-on work.
Yeah.
And we provide a lot of documentation, which the Canadian Wheat Board, Lake Shippers Clearance Association, all these other agencies rely on, the documentation that we do. Because it's such a niche-friendly market now that they have to have a lot of documentation per each level of grain that's handled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The odd thing is that from the 30s, when the Canadian Wheat Board was created or recreated, since there had been one, something like that, during the Great War, the pools which had been established to try to establish farmers' power in the marketplace, and which could conceivably establish all of these functions within their own. The Wheat Board really has taken that over. The Grain Commission, of course, had earlier roots, but has developed and so on and so forth. With Viterra now having become the kind of company it is, so it isn't really a pool any longer, one wonders whether the capacity is there on behalf of the farmers. But anyway, that I'm sort of speculating.
Yeah, there's a huge change, yeah. So, you know, it used to be the Board of Grain Commissioners. It used to be... We used to be a very powerful entity in the picture. We became part of the agricultural component, and with that we became less of an instrument to decide the fate of the grain rather than just a agency that oversees part of the function. So there's been a change in our level of policing.
Yes.
The level of, when I first started the job, whatever an inspector in charge of a plant said, he was like God.
Yes.
And the elevator company manager listened to every word he said. Yeah. He was the man that they...
Well, the board was established originally really against the companies on behalf of the farmers.
That has changed. Now we're a service provider almost to the, to not only the... less to the farmer and more to the elevator company, helping them.
Although
it's a good process. It helps. I mean, it helps the final process of moving the grain through the system for the satisfaction of the customer. But that's been a huge change where we've gone from a real policeman to more of a helper to get this through the system.
Sure. What are you most proud of in this work?
My level of, my level of expertise. I feel that I'm a professional in what I do. I try to do the best I can for everybody. It's been hard times to do that because we have changed a lot over the years. I'm proud of the fact that I have been with my employer for 34 years. And
through thick and thin.
through thick and thin and have done
to the best of my ability, the best job that I could possibly do, eh? Not have been disciplined or criticized for my work, you know, the work that I have achieved for them. So,
is there recognition within the commission, awards?
No more or less. Yes, there is. We have what we call a Bravo Award. It's an award that fellow recognition from your fellow, you know, workers. We have that once a year. We also have the federal government has a recognition years of service, so 25 years, 35 years, stuff like that. So there is recognition that way. If you come up with some new ideas, there's recognition. So there's different reasons to be, I guess, recognized as you go through the career.
And protecting the workers, of course, is the function of the union, the Public Service Alliance. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, I've been the president of our local here for several years. I've been involved on the executive of our local here for probably 10 to 12 years. I've been sent to Ottawa for training for union matters. I've done a lot of court cases. I've done representation for grievances up to and including the deputy chief. So I'm very involved in the union, and I have been for many years,
And you're pleased with that, if not even...
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
I'm sure.
Whether my management does or not, that's a different matter. But, I mean, the union is recognized. Your rights as an employee are recognized by the federal government, and so I feel comfortable with that. I've enjoyed doing that over the years. Whether it's been detrimental to my career or not, you know, so it's hard to say.
You're given time off, I guess, from the inspection to do it, or does it have to be mostly done after?
We try to do it during, you know, I mean, if I have to go to represent somebody to Winnipeg or whatever, where our head office is, you're given, you know, you're paid to do that. It's just covered under your regular wage. You get travel expenses. If I have to take time off for a hearing in Thunder Bay, that's it's done under usually working hours. So basically, yeah, everything's, you know, you're compensated for doing that.
Sure.
If I take time off to go to Ottawa, where the PSAC head office is, then I take leave time for that, and I'm reimbursed by the PSAC
union.
For that.
The union. Brilliant. Well, I hardly have to ask whether you think the work that you've done has contributed to Canada's success as an international grain trader. The answer is enthusiastic yes, I'm sure.
Oh, for sure. Well, you know, I've worked coast to coast. I've met many people. I feel comfortable that Canada probably has one of the best systems in place right now to protect people from around the world that are buying our grains. So,
sure. You know. And on the other side, connections between your work and the work of farmers growing the grain. Well, you've sketched that in terms of the concerns they sometimes feel about the grading and so on and so forth. And the assurance.
I work well with farmers that come to our offices over the years, and you know, I think that they. Of any person, probably a lot of the farmers didn't realize how much we do in regards to their concerns.
Do farmers appear in groups or as individuals? Or do they get in
touch? Come as individuals, usually as tourists. Those.
Yeah.
So
can you sketch one of those when you encounter with a farmer who is visiting the lake? Do they come here deliberately to see something of the?
Well, I had a farmer here that was actually. Farmed right next door to the chief commissioner, the Canadian Grain Commission, who was a lady at the time, and he was a farmer agent. So basically what he did is he grew lentils, and he and another group of farmers decided that they would try to run lentils, a shipment of lentils through Thunder Bay. And so basically he acted as a farmer because it was his grain, but he also acted as an agent. And so I met with him. He came to my office at the time, and he was very... So it was interesting. It was interesting. He enjoyed it, and whether he was successfully able to keep doing that or not, I'm not sure because I haven't run into him since then. But it's interesting when you talk to the farmers. They're businessmen too. And they would like to make sure that their product is well represented and they get the best bang for their buck. And so definitely you have to treat them as. As a client, almost, and that you're here to represent them and to try to make sure that they get a fair shake.
I'm going to move into the changes area. You've mentioned some of the changes. Do you want to do a review or add to the list, perhaps?
Yeah. The biggest change has been, you know, just the advent of computers and
technological changes in the unloading and handling. Tankers from boxcars, huge change. Automation in the plants themselves, where when Viterra got fully automated, I laughed because the engineer that was, I guess it would be a techie engineer, that's how technical the plant has become. Everything's automated, it runs on electronics and computers and that. And the computers used to be as big as this room, now they're as small as this little desktop here. Eh? So, yeah,
a laptop.
A laptop, yeah. So basically, a huge changes there. With that, unfortunately, comes the downsizing. Automation means
labor.
A lot less labor. The other big changes has been the volume of grain coming through Thunder Bay. We used to run plants here, we're running at full capacity for 8 to 9 months of the year, and then at half capacity in the wintertime. Now our big plants are hardly running at all.
Yeah. Well, I will remember that as in politics in 84, Frank Mazur moved my nomination, the president of the Lodge 650 of the grain handlers, and I think he had probably 1,800 members along the waterfront.
Yeah.
And these days, if there are 180 working.
That's right. So, you know, niche markets compared to, you know, shipping to Russia, all our product, all one Red Spring, two Red Spring wheat, for certain markets, for certain reasons, a lot of that. So the level of expertise, the level of quality of oversight of the grain inspection has to be a lot more able to change on a yearly basis.
When you mentioned 70 countries buying, are there dominant ones amongst them, or is it
really United States? We ship a lot of a lot of grain that used to have to come through Thunder Bay in order to, for it to be exported to the United States. Now it just crosses the prairies. Eh? So we ship a lot of grain to the United States. We ship a lot of grain to Britain. A lot of grain to Germany. A lot of grain to China. Japan, then all the little countries accordingly thereof. Okay, take
so there
different.
Three major. Well, continental, a couple in on the Atlantic market and a couple on the Pacific market that are the major.
I'll give you an example. A country like Liberia or Armenia, like that, will look at a certain flatbread. So they'll take a certain specific grain, which would be like three red, which would be a lower quality. Again, niche markets. They'll take one maybe boatload a year. Two boatloads a year, so basically that's what we're looking at.
The impact of these changes, of course, you've already indicated during the reduction of employment and so on and so forth. The work becomes a lot easier.
Oh, definitely.
There's a lot less of it to be done well in terms of
I mean, the work for especially for the grain handler himself is a lot more, easier on your body. If to say anything else, there's not that much. Yeah, occasionally they get a spill there where they have to do a little, but now the spills are unhandled, they'll call in a vacuum truck company and they'll vacuum it all up, and so there's none of that hand bombing, unless you get a little spill at the end of a belt or something like that. But we just had a big spill at one of the elevators where roughly seven boxcars, so that would be seven nines, about 600 tons of grain broke. Open a little hole in the elevator bin, and so that grain was on the ground. Well, they called in, like I said, they called in hoses and recycled it into the plant again, so not much labor involved there. So stuff like that is just the mechanical fact that things have changed so much has made it so much easier for everybody. Even in my job now, all those samples are pneumatically delivered into our office, and they come in a pneumatic tube into the office, and then they're released into a bucket. We dump them on our bench. It's just a lot easier for everybody.
Yeah. Pollution control, dust control, was one of the things that went on, what, through the 1970s primarily?
Starting initially, but the big push on that was in the 80s to 90s.
That recent?
Yeah. And so ever since, and even then, with the environmental concerns, the dust factor is huge, you know, environmental releases into the lake, all those factors have been carefully monitored, and so therefore the plants are a lot cleaner to work in. They're still, you know, you still have your dust and that, but they're a lot cleaner. Rodent control, wouldn't be uncommon to find a bin on fire inside the plant. And nowadays, you know, You don't see anything like that at all.
This would be damp grain, I suppose, was it?
Well, just out of condition grain, eh? Left in not turned, not sold, left in condition. It doesn't take long. If the grain level, the dampness in the grain is high, canola being one of the worst ones, if it's over 9 to 10% moisture content, if you leave that in there a whole year, it'll start to get out of condition. It'll heat within the core,
yes.
And it'll actually blacken in the core. It'll burn within the core of the grain there. So you go to move it, you can't. It's been burnt. And so basically the elevator companies have gotten smarter. The product is very expensive at $400 to $500 a ton. If you lose 270 tons, you're talking a lot of money. So basically they have to, the plant superintendents, whether they like it or not, have to monitor their plants very closely and very carefully.
Keep things moving.
It's huge loss of money, yeah. And they're responsible for that. So they have to be very careful.
Yeah, I could see that. These various changes, have there been other challenges on the job that you might...
If you're talking for the Canadian Grain Commission employees, just challenges of surviving and the downsizing, mm-hmm. surviving to try to keep work level and the amount of volume here enough to sustain a workforce. Changes within the regulatory process is ongoing. That's a big challenge for our staff here, for future staff. We're going through a transition now. When I first came on, it was war vets. Then I was a new guy on the block. Now I'm leaving and new people are coming on. It's a challenge to keep younger staff on because of the uncertainty. Challenges for management, because they're caught in a bad spot. They want to maintain. We're running down a track with two rails there. One rail may lead to deregulation, but in the meantime, they have to maintain a level of expertise to satisfy the industry. It's tough. It's I feel for our managers because I love the deputy head who has to do the will of the board, chief commissioner who's a political appointment. So, it's tough. It's a tough situation for them to be in right now.
And ultimately, your best thoughts may be contradicted by political will at the very top. And that it seems to be, having enjoyed the freedom that an academic has. Study, teaching, and so on and so forth. That seems to be one of the worst parts of the system when you are subjected in those ways. The industry is federally controlled, I guess, is it? Entirely.
Yes.
So that the dust control, the pollution control, that's all federal regulation as well, or does the province come into
provinces it? Can be involved. So if we have a discharge into the lake or if somebody looks and sees a big dust cloud over the elevator, they'll call the Ministry of Environment. It can even go down to a municipal situation. We've had concerns in the plant and, called bylaw officers in. Health and safety regulations usually is federally run. So different can go possibly wrong in an environment like that.
You were referring to the workforce a few moments ago, your colleagues. The workforce used to be male. And then women entered it as well along the way, I suppose.
When I was when I started, women there was basically
1975. Yeah. Did you say
basically no women at all in the job? And when I when I was hired on, I was hired on with approximately 4 or 5 females. There was about 20 of us hired on locally here to do succession planning, more or less. And it was very tough. It was very because you were entering into a male-dominated work site where you could go into a lunchroom and there'd be every Playboy picture in the world posted up there. And so when women started to come into that work site...
And it was at that time in 75, was it?
75, and when they came into those work sites, and because our function, even though we were not grain handlers, we worked with a lot of our young women moving into that because they were subjected to a very tough time, very trying times for them.
A certain amount of harassment, I guess. Pure
harassment. There was a lot of harassment. There was at the time, up until when I started, and even after I started, there was a lot of drinking involved in the, in that particular trade.
Inspectors too.
Inspectors, grain handlers. It was just, everybody had a bottle. It seemed so, and it was. It was just one of those things, and so
alcoholism was
rampant.
Endemic,
rampant. Yeah, it was rampant.
We've heard that from many, but yours is not the first comment by any.
There was, I don't know how, and it was not only grain handlers, grain trimmers, government staff. It was just everybody was, whether, you know.
Was there any attempt to counter the alcohol consumption to any
not
extent?
At all. Not at all.
No.
Not at all.
No one was encouraged to go to AA.
There was no reason for it because the bosses were just as heavily involved in that factor as everybody else. What brought it to a head was safety concerns where we actually lost grain handlers. And so the companies themselves made the first move to ban alcohol from their plants.
When did that occur?
I'm going to say mid-80s.
Mid-80s,
we had a death, and then we had a couple of near deaths, and so that brought about, you know, and the times are changing, you know.
Yeah.
The new people were moving in, and some of the older people were moving out, and I think with that more better habits, to say the least, smoking, you guys would be smoking in a dust environment there, cigarettes all over the place, you know.
In the elevator.
And so that
and
all...
didn't ignite the dust.
No, so basically what happened then is that all sort of came about with the changes in people, new people coming in, more professional managers coming in, that brought about, it was just a change, I think, not only in the grain industry, but in a lot of other industries that was happening too. So now I can also actually say, can't even smoke in front of a plant now, let alone have any alcohol. So
I wonder if alcohol was always a part of work at the Lakehead, or this is I hesitate within a week of Remembrance Day to wonder whether the veterans coming back with alcohol can
it's
part of military life, I fear.
Yeah, we had a lot of military vets, and they went through a lot of traumatic experiences, I'm sure, in the war, And so whether that was post-traumatic stress disorder or any of those other factors that were involved in that, the Lakehead being a very blue-collar town at the time with all the industries that we had, part of it, frustration, you know, all those things, that those factors end up with 30, 35 years in the same job, doing the same thing, still, all those factors, so.
Yes. I don't know whether to ask... what major challenges do you think the grain industry faced over the years? You may have sketched everything you'd want to say in that regard.
To sum it up, I would say for the grain industry, the Canadian Grain Commission.
Yes.
Has been the value, the sense of the worth of the value that we do to the industry, meaning that do we do something that's going to be beneficial to the trade?
Right.
And is there a requirement for that? As regards the industry itself, how else can you mass move grain in Canada in an effective manner if you don't have a properly functioning industry such as the grain elevator companies that do it? Yeah. And I think they do a marvelous job. You know,
I suppose it's the market that would pose. I mean, there are other challenges, parasites, what have you, rust, the need to develop another new variety of wheat and whatnot for the farmers. So there are all kinds of challenges, but I suppose at this point it would be the appearance of the importance of Russia for a time and then its disappearance. The beginning of the opening of the Chinese market back around 1960 when Alvin Hamilton forged those links to the conservative party. So those would be some of the biggest changes, certainly.
Big changes, but I think, you know what? I think we should be proud in Thunder Bay and Northwestern Ontario that we have adapted to those changes and we've done a good job and we move a lot of grain efficiently. We move it, with all the parties working together, whether it's the grain trimmers doing an excellent job, the grain handlers, the railway companies, the inspection, the weighing staffs, the elevator management, our management, they all work together. They've all adapted to huge changes, and they have been huge changes, you know, a loss of a market, changes of requirements, more government regulation, you know, scares in the market over the years we've had for different products. You know, we've done a good job. I'm pretty proud that everybody has pitched in when they had to and enabled us to maintain that.
Yes.
We went through things that the forest industry are going through now, downsizing, changing of, we went through all of that and managed to survive and create our own niche, I guess, to service all these other.
When one thinks of the Northern Ontario over the past 30 or so years, maybe a bit more, I think of Sudbury and the impact on the mining industry there when the, I guess it was mechanization in part, that much reduced the number of miners required. Of course, the pulp and paper industry had some downsizing in employment in the late 70s when there was significant investment, but you're suggesting the same thing, of course, for the grain handlers and so on and so forth. These have been really body blows to some extent to the prosperity of Northern Ontario, and we continue to struggle with them these days.
And you know what? On any given day, if the market was to change and volume was to pick up, you know, staff have been kept up in all the different organizations to pick up enough labor, extra labor out of the labor pool, to meet the challenges that the future could present to us. So, right. You know, what more can you say about the effectiveness of the system than the fact that they can rise to those occasions if they show up again?
Well put. What are your most vivid memories of the job?
Just the people that I've worked with, the challenges, you know, the different places that I've been, the different people that I've met over the years, in particular, any particular memories? No, just a whole bunch of good ones, I guess, basically. Yeah. I can't really say that I've had the 35 years have gone, you know, with the Canadian Grain Commission, and prior to that, I've gone by, you know, quickly, and health-wise, you know, my health is still good from all of that, and, you know, because the job I do, I've been able to, travel and meet different people, and had lots of, working with the government, had lots of training, and kept up my training, and, you know, feel current, eh? Yes. So what more can you ask for it, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Been well rewarded, well paid for the work I've done, have done a good job, I feel, and feel able that I can move on to something else, no problem.
Yes, you have some retirement plans.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I ever want to retire. I enjoy working, so that's. I mean, that's something that I might retire to something else. As I speak to two gentlemen who've probably done that here already.
Well, certainly one of the happiest,
found their own niches in
happiest
life
lots in life is to retire from the work that you did, to continue doing those parts of it that you really enjoy.
I laugh because most of my fellow workers that have retired have gone on to other jobs for industry or other jobs in the grain.
Have they now?
Oh yeah, for sure. So.
Are there most important events that you'd want to spotlight in terms of happening in the workplace that affected your career? I begin to feel some of these questions are a bit repetitious, actually, in terms of, because you've been very skillfully focusing on such things as changes, challenges, and so on.
Big challenge for me was whether to get involved with the union or not. For me, it was a big challenge.
Yeah, I guess
it was a big challenge because... even though under the Charter of Rights that you have the right to, you know, be a member of a union and freedom of, you know, freedom to speech and that, it's sometimes perceived a career-ending move. I don't know if that's the case or not, but that was a big challenge for me to get involved. Once I got involved, I never looked back. I enjoyed it. I had my ups and downs. I would say I had more ups and downs in my union involvement than I ever had in my career with the Canadian Grain Commission. So. That probably was one of the biggest.
What sorts of things? Challenges simply in serving within the union?
Yeah,
the dynamics of the local?
Making decisions on behalf of the union membership that were perceived to be my decisions and not those of the local. And so with that, you know, you're perceived as being, you know, black sheep of the family, to say the least, okay?
So the issues of sort of democracy in the local...
Well, representing
would be
people,
a challenge.
Yeah, representing people in the local. We have, you know, people that have gone through a lot of tough times in our particular, as anybody would in a long term career in the government or in any industry. Things change. You become part of a family. Where, to give you an example, where you were all right for the longest amount of time. Other factors have affected you and changed you as an employee, and so, but you're still part of that family. And so, how does your employer adapt to those changes in your life as you move through the system? And you know, is there any leniency? You know, are you able to maintain your job if you have trouble? You know, that you need help. You know, all those things that can happen in a person's, because of the factor that we do have a lot of long-term employees. Most of the people that I work with now are 45 or older, and have been with the commission for 25 to 35 years. So, you know, I spend more time with them than I have with my spouse. And so with that in mind, you know, you live with all of their problems and all of their things that occur in a person's life.
Have you faced work stoppage issues?
Yes, we have. We faced many. The government, through no fault of their own, initially wanted to lay, we're full-time, indeterminate full-time employees, all of us. And so basically the government tried to lay us off. Then we fought that challenge and won. And then they put us on what they call temporary interruption of employment, which was just another term to lay us off. And basically because we lost Russia, because the crops failed, we had a couple of years where the crops failed, we had very low volume, we had a certain set amount of staff. So basically the government was faced with, they have to work within a budget. You know, every agency now, it's not unlimited money at the end of the year. If you don't use it, you lose it. And you have to project, and all of a sudden the volume, we work in an industry where we charge for the services we do. And so if there's no volume there to pay for our costs, we have to go to the Treasury Board to ask for more money. So our managers have to do that. If we take in $30 million, our costs are $50 million, we have to go to the Treasury Board and say, hey, like we need $20 million. And they look at my manager, CEO, and say, like, hey, get your affairs in order there, buddy, because you're an agency now that has to provide for itself. So they're faced with those challenges, and so what do you do? Most of our cost factor is labor pool, so they look at the, but they don't, you know, we said if you have to change our distinction from an intermittent employee to a seasonal employee, then you have to change, we work under a contract, you have to change that contract. Well, they weren't prepared to do that. And so you have all those challenges, they try to do different things, we fought. We went to the Supreme Court, we fought these through grievances, et cetera, et cetera. So it was tough.
So it wasn't so much a matter of strike, which is, I was using word stoppage, yeah. Word stoppage rather, as a euphemism.
We've had those. We've had strikes, because we've had...
Strike and layoffs are, lockouts and so on are obviously...
Different factors, but we've had strikes, we've been on strike. We were on strike for close to a month, and we were ordered back to work in the PC government. We were in our... We were 3 years.
In the 80s?
That was...
The early 90s?
The 90s. That was with Mulroney.
Yeah, the Mulroney.
And his Treasury Board official, or his...
Minister
of the Treasury Board, ordered us back to work and imposed a settlement on us. So we were given 0% for the first year. I think you were in that. 0% for the second year and 3% for the third year. Ordered back to work. Well, we felt that you can order us back to work.
Yeah.
But you can't impose a settlement, but they did. And so all the union members felt that our union hierarchy in Ottawa, who was Gerald Bean at the time, let us down, major. But that's another problem. But we've been through...
Another challenge.
Yeah, so we've been through work stoppages. We had, we walked off the job in Thunder Bay here under a right to, you know, bad conditions we were working under. So we've done that. So we've been through, you know, and when you go through all of those challenges and you're involved in the union hierarchy, you're identified. And, you know, so, you know.
You should also have protection, though, because you're working on
your protected, your job is kept.
Yes.
Okay? But your chances of advancement in the process are going to be limited. Because, as I say with merit, and if I'm wrong, you can correct me at this time here. Ernie, you like me, we get along really good, okay? I do a good job for you, and I've got good merit because you're my boss. But tomorrow you retire and Owen becomes my boss. I'm still the same Steve, I still do the same work, but Owen and I don't get along. Now, is my merit going to stay the same? No.
It should.
It should, it should, but it doesn't, okay?
It doesn't.
And so basically... No, that's the process of merit, as far as I'm concerned. With seniority, if management does seniority properly, if I have a problem as an employee and it's corrected along the way, which it can be done through letters of reprimand, discipline, more intensive training, any of those factors along the way, then eventually with seniority, and I become, you know, I'll be able to move through the ranks as long as I'm capable and willing enough to do a higher position.
Yes.
With merit, 2 years on the job and, you're well liked by the boss, you can go to the top of the ladder, and the guy who's been there for 15, 20 years doing the consistent job may not get anywhere because he's...
Sounds as if merit has a particular definition
that
doesn't resonate with my own experience, but I see...
So
terminology does develop.
Yeah, so basically I know I've lived that, I realize that myself. I've been a witness to that in things that I've done. And so, you know, that's one of my regrets is the fact that when I made a decision to get involved in the union, did I do the right thing at the time? I feel I have because that's the way I am. I'm a rights-based person.
Sure.
But,
well, I'm partial to that view myself and think that the election as president and continuing as president is the final evidence of that kind of quality.
Yeah.
That's merit to my mind if your co-workers continue you in the position.
But I have merit with my co-workers. But do I have merit with my manager?
Yeah,
especially if I make firm decisions based on union principles for my fellow local members against management's decision.
Yes.
And some of these decisions have been very, very important.
Well, I do understand that to some extent from the experiences in my own life years ago as it happens. But I do understand that. Do you think it's important for us to be doing this? Historical work, interviewing you and others?
I think so, because I think that it's... there's a perceived history of the grain... trade in Thunder Bay in northwestern Ontario and for that part Manitoba, but it's nice to have it in principle. It's nice to have an oral presentation. It's nice to have for future generations the history of it as presented by people that were involved in that history. I think it's just a great. That's why I was more than willing when I ran into Owen to partake in this process because I think it's just invaluable. We're a grain town. Sure, we're a forestry town. But we're also a huge grain town.
Oh, yes.
And it's provided a lot of well-paid, quality jobs for a lot of people in Thunder Bay over the years and will into the future. And
the city was doing this a generation before it really began to produce pulp and paper. So this is an old, old industry in this city. Are there any questions you think we should have asked?
I think we've covered as...
The questionnaire covers it, but Owen probably has a query or two. Please.
Just one question. I know that I was much in the same situation as you were, but in a different part of the federal government where I was coming in at the end of the reign of the war veteran and moving into a group of people coming in, and we went on our way. But when I look back at those days, I can remember people that instilled in me a feeling and a set of principles for the work I was doing, and I still think very fondly of them. Some are still here, and many of them passed on. Did you have any specific individuals that kind of acted as mentors for you in the beginning? Because you have very strongly held, views about your responsibilities in this particular position.
Yeah, I had one. I worked with most of the gentlemen that I worked with at the time were war veterans. In fact, I don't think I can remember any that weren't. That were either at entry level, that were either inspectors or people that had been moved up into inspector in charge. A couple of them was Mr. Roy. When I entered the trade, he was just in the process of retiring. Wilf Boulanger, who I worked a lot of years with, I had a lot of respect for him. He was a very, very professional man, a true gentleman. George Adams, another gentleman that I worked years with. We didn't move around as much in those days, so we were sort of working in a unit with because we were learning. We were usually stuck with people for 6-7 months at the time. So I worked with a lot of different vets, and I worked with a lot of the older people. Mr. Lemoore, you guys have interviewed here. I worked with him. He was working at he was working in Saskatchewan. We pulled 4A in Curtin River at the time. So
Yeah, all these I picked up from these gentlemen. They're all, a lot of them had good principles. They felt that they were doing something that the job that they were doing definitely had meaning, and that was one of the biggest things that I felt that I carried or I picked up from them, was the sense that this was about doing something that was a need. So,
and just one more question, and you mentioned that you came in when women were just being introduced to the labor market, that's the force at that time. And you talked very well about some of the challenges they met. When did it become just a natural thing for a woman to work on the job? I mean, we started in 1975, but when did things start?
You'd probably be able to answer that question because you were involved in with Canada Manpower for years. But I'm going to say probably it was well into the late 80s, early 90s, when they were, after the women that I had, inspector in charge, female promoted, we were getting a lot of people from other origins into Thunder Bay and other nationalities, and so they were coming onto the job. So now the push was not so much against the women, it was more to help other minorities coming on, so women were almost fully accepted. And because we joined, now we were the senior people, and so they became well accepted because we accepted them. When we joined with them, when we started working with them, it was natural for us, okay? And so it's just a generational thing as far as I'm concerned. We went through a generation where I can remember when I was a young person, all the dads worked and all the moms were at home. And so now we're going through where everybody works, okay? Nobody's at home. And so that was sort of like what happened with us. When I came on the job, it was all men. I came on with some young women. I was a young man. So that was natural for me. It wasn't natural for them. And so when we started moving, just like any other industry, we're fully acceptable of women in the workforce.
Did employment equity have a significant impact?
Yes, it did. It did. The initiative from the federal government was employment.
Early 80s or through 84 and so on.
But in order, because it was a blue-collar industry, in order for it to break into the blue-collar industry was a little tougher. And so, but it was the women that were hired where they knew that they had their rights and they felt comfortable and they were well opinionated women that they could express their views. Yes. We accepted them, so we sort of stuck up for them. And it helped them, being fellow workers, young workers with them, it helped them brave this thing. Because they weren't only working, trying to get into the grain inspection department and weighing department, but they were also trying to get into a grain industry where it was all male-dominated.
Yeah. The grain handlers. And by employment equity, I was thinking also of visible minorities.
Oh, definitely, so on.
Yeah. Is the grain commission now?
Yes. We have significant numbers of... More so in the West Coast because of the huge population of visible minorities in the West Coast.
Sikhs,
but even
Chinese,
now that's really happening in Thunder Bay here in the last, I'm going to say the last 5 to 10 years, anybody that we hire, a lot of people we hire, it's based on your abilities, not your...
your capacity and potential merit, eh? Right. Well, I think we've actually... covered the basic questionnaire. There's the matter of memorabilia, and you're still actually briefly in the industry. Were there any previous union leaders that inspired you at all? Presidents of the local...
Excuse me.
You murmured Darrell Bean's name with a little mixed emotions I caught in terms of what they'd accepted. Anyone in the local scene, leader of your local?
Finally caught up with me. I learned already. Excuse me.
Maybe we should.
I would say probably Frank Mazur.
Great handlers. Yeah. A splendid interview, and you've provided a great narration. We're very pleased that you've taken it on, especially with your voice. Your throat was a bit scratchy. So we'll cut it off.